The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Adams v. York. Counsel, just to remind you, each of you will have 15 minutes of argument time with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. That's fine. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, the timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which you may lower or raise to your height for your convenience. There's a button right in front. I think, is that your water or did somebody else leave that for you?
This is my water.
Okay, good. That's fine. That's good. I want to make sure it wasn't left. Last argument, we had things left around.
It's my first time, too.
Oh.
Well, you're welcome. Your water's just fine there. I just want to make sure it wasn't left over. You can raise or lower the lectern to match your height. State your name as you come into each leg of your argument, because we only keep an audio recording for the public, and that way you can be attached to your argument. And counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may do so.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Calandra Revering, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Antoinette York. I know that the court has a firm grasp on the facts, and you've read our pleadings and our briefing, so I will jump into my argument and provide a roadmap for our conversation today. Justices, I believe this case should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing because the court failed to follow the law by denying an evidentiary hearing despite modifying parenting time in a way that altered the child's primary residence. Number two, created a de facto change of custody without applying the best interest factors and made improper factual determinations. And number four, improperly weighed racial and socioeconomic factors in determining the child's school placement.
Can I jump into the first? I think it was the first argument you said you're going to discuss, which was the evidentiary hearing. Was that the lack of an evidentiary hearing and a de facto restriction? So this is an interesting case. I think the district court was correct when it said this is unique in that you have parents who live in two different states.
Agreed, Your Honor.
At the beginning, and that's sort of and there were two primary residences.
Yes, Your Honor.
The difficulty I have with your argument in the frame, whether the district court erred in framing the issues, is the way the district court was given the issues by the parties. As I read the transcript and the district court's approach, we have this December 2022 order denying your client's motion for modification, but then teeing up what the case was going to be going forward, which was a question of where the primary residence was going to be, and that would be based in part or almost entirely on what the parties were arguing about, which is which school the child should attend. And as I read the transcript, I believe you were counsel in the district court as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you argued to the district court that we don't need an evidentiary hearing to make this decision, and that this isn't a case about restricting parenting time. This is a case just about where the child should go to school, and that would drive the question of removal. Am I correct that that's how the case was teed up by the parties in the district court?
Your Honor, for the most part, you're correct, but I would like to add in a couple of other facts. I don't believe that the son has set on the request for an evidentiary hearing, because in our written pleadings, we did request in the alternative an evidentiary hearing. And this court has repeatedly held that alternative requests do not constitute a waiver. So we did include that request in our written motion in 2023, that in the alternative, we would like to have an evidentiary hearing.
And that was presented before the argument were made before the
Yes,
court?
That was filed with our argument.
Right, but then at the time that you make your argument to the district court, it was, I mean, if I'm in the district court's shoes, I'm left with the feeling that dad is wanting an evidentiary hearing, But mom says, we don't, expressly, we do not need an evidentiary hearing. You can decide this case. And here's, and the framework the court had already set out and the affidavit process was sufficient. That was the argument that was made on behalf of mom. It's hard, at least for, I don't speak for the court, I'm just my own brainstorming here. I'm having a hard time believing that, hard time framing how we would tell the district court that the district court made a mistake by following the party's framing of the dispute, as a matter of the procedural framing of the dispute and the standards under which the court should have acted.
So, Your Honor, I think that the court was faced with putting a round peg into a square hole. And what I mean by that is, under Minnesota Statute 518, that statute contemplates one parent moving out of the state, and there's a procedure for that. Mm-hmm. But the statute does not contemplate a child whose primary residence is in two different states.
Exactly, and so when the district court issued its order in December 2022, trying to put that,
yes.
that peg into that hole,
yes.
it seems to me that would be the time for either party to say, no, the court got it wrong, we should follow a different procedure, recognizing that the statute doesn't really fit this, and the court framed, took from, what the court did the best it could to figure out what process it should apply, and neither party appealed that decision. Was that order appealable or not appealable in your view?
Your Honor, I believe that order could have been appealable, and with all due respect, I think at that time, we both were not sure why the court took the next step of denying both of our motions and then ordering that we asked for another motion hearing, but apply the.
I think the court said why it was denying the motions, because the motions that were made were to modify, and the way it was framed was endangerment. And the court said, "Look, both parties are agreeing. There's not really endangerment here." And I think the court was getting in what was really at the heart of it, which I think we all agree, looking at the record, seems mm-hmm. to be what the heart of it was you have three problems here. If there are three situations, you've got the age of the child, you've got the distance that the parents live apart from each other, and the fact that they're primarily, the child primarily resides at both with equal parenting time. And you've got school on the horizon. Some one of these parties is going to win the position argument. And so the question is, and how do you, what do you need to, what's the real issue? And the issue seems to be, well, what's the better thing for the child when it comes to this, the placement, the school? I think that's how it was framed at the district court. And unless you correct me, I think that's how it was argued by you on behalf of your client. It should have been framed in the district court.
Yes, because I did try to attempt a favorable result for my client. Mm-hmm. But in my pleadings, I did analyze the best interest factors and the out-of-state factors, anticipating that it could go either way. But I think that the court, in looking at the court's order, the court misapplied the law. And we are here on an abuse of discretion standard, because what the court then did was the court then de facto altered the parent-child relationship and essentially altered custody factors without an evidentiary hearing.
Now, if your client had won, the court would have been doing the same thing, but...
Your Honor, I believe you were in my prep. Because that's exactly what I said. We would be in the same position asking for an evidentiary hearing, likely against Mr. Adams. So I
prove what? There's not an argument. No one's argued on appeal that, in fact, a prima facie case of endangerment was established. So there's no right to an evidentiary hearing under the endangerment standard. I mean, that doesn't seem to be before us. And then if we look under for modification of custody, and if we look under the remedies, under the 0.175, that's either restriction, endangerment, or, you know, interference, I think, with parenting. No one's arguing that. So what statutory standard Are you saying you have a right to an evidentiary hearing when not when those issues don't even seem to be presented to the district court to decide? With the exception of endangerment, with the district court rejected, and it's that's not doesn't appear to be before us.
I think that under Minnesota Statute 518.175, when you have a five-year-old who now spends 9 months out of the year with her father, I think that's now a restriction, which then triggers an evidentiary hearing.
On what topics? What needs to be proved for restriction? On it's endangerment or interference, right?
Yes.
But no one's arguing that.
That is correct.
So then it seems like why didn't the district court, I mean, I know it went under the, you know, the idea of removing or moving to a different state, mm-hmm. but the district court considered broadly, I think, the best interest of the child. And an educational decision is a question of legal custody. We know from case law that when parents who share legal custody don't agree on a school, that the district court is meant to apply the best interest of the child. And when I looked at the best interests of the child under with the district court, the factors it identified, I compared it with the point, the 517 general best interest standards. I don't see, and looking at your brief and what the district court wrote, I'm having a hard time seeing what factors you think the district court didn't take into consideration. What factors? I mean, I appreciate the, because the district court repeated, I think, when I look at your brief and you say what the interests are, I think the district court addressed all of that, or wrote about it, at least, in its order, perhaps under a factor that you might not think it falls under, I'm not sure. But I don't see what factors are missing. It seems to me, at the end of the day, to be more about how the court weighed them and considered them than that the district court didn't fairly consider best interest factors.
Your Honor, I don't think the court considered all of the best interest factors. I think the court looked at out-of-state factors.
But Which ones did it not consider?
I think that it did not consider the relationship the child had with her siblings at home. I think the court did not consider the child's relationship to the community. And I think the court's decision was framed in a way that it was a parenting time modification, but the court's reasoning was actually a best factors analysis, which should have triggered an evidentiary hearing. I think the way the court weighed
under
the evidence.
Under what case law or statute would require an evidentiary hearing? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Where you would look and what you would have to be proved. Because it seems like the evidentiary hearing that's required is for standards that no one is really arguing here. I mean, it seems, frankly, these are loving parents that have been cooperative, and if they lived in the same city and they couldn't decide on the school within the same city, the district court would have to decide then as an exercise, you know, what the legal custody issues, which school, but that there wouldn't be these other issues, you know. They live apart, which is really unfortunate for them and the child. You know, there's a lot to manage. I understand why, but.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. And to answer your question, under Mattson v. Mattson, it's a clear violation of Minnesota precedent requiring evidentiary hearings when a substantial parenting time modification is at issue. And I don't think that the court took into consideration as she was retiring that this case required an evidentiary hearing, especially after analyzing the facts and understanding that the way her order was structured significantly altered the parent-child relationship, require an analysis of the best interest factors, and that requires a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, so that we could provide testimony, possibly have a custody evaluation, and cross-examination.
Again, the difficulty I'm having is that when your client's opponent, when the respondent made those arguments, your argument was, no, none of that's necessary. You can decide this case based upon the affidavits. You don't need a hearing. And so that's what's troubling. You mentioned that the district court failed to consider the relationship that the child had with other, with the half-siblings and stepfather and others, but the district court's order does discuss those things as presented an issue. So I don't know, it's hard to find fault. I'm curious, is there something that's not in the district court's decision and analysis that should have been there in order to demonstrate, that would help us to see that the district court missed some significant fact or factor in deciding the best interests of the child as it relates to relocating the child?
I think what the court could have done is the court could have balanced its order so that the parent-child relationship was not so deeply altered. And that did not happen. I think that the way...
Be deeply altered, you mean because of the amount of time that was that one parent has versus the other at this point?
Absolutely, because as you can see from the pleadings...
But isn't that what you asked for? You asked the district court to do exactly what the district court did, only with your client having the school year and the respondent having the summers. Everything, I think, was right down the line with what you requested, except that the district court felt that in the end, the dad's choice of school, seems to me, if you get right down to it,
yes,
dad's choice of school, having a better academic environment, mm-hmm, weighed more heavily than the arguments for the school in Madison. That's the way I read the opinion. The district court seemed to express the difficulty and the uniqueness and the challenges, but it seemed like the district court followed exactly the roadmap that you provided, that your client provided for the district court to follow. It just took a different turn at the point where the district court had to make a decision as to who won. Correct me if I'm wrong about any of that.
No, Your Honor, I believe that you are correct. However, advocating for my client's position does not stop the court from still coming up with a solution that neither party is really prevented from having a significant relationship with the child. And to your other point, Your Honor, about the focus on the school choice, I think that was improper because I think that it implies that if a parent lives in a more affluent school district and has a racial makeup that fits their situation, I think that we send a message to parents in this situation or in any custody situation that you will get more preferential treatment if you live in a better school district. And I don't think it was improper. I don't think it was proper for the court to weigh her decision heavily on that. Because I also think that when you include so much ethnic centrism into an order, I think it goes completely against Minnesota case law.
I didn't see the court, with all respect, I didn't see the court making an ethnocentric decision. I thought, at least the way the court described it, mm-hmm, your argument on behalf of your client was that the child would be better suited in an environment where there's more racial diversity. And father was arguing that the child would be better suited in a school that has a greater success rate. And if I'm looking at the district court, I'm looking at the numbers, and I think, well, the options were the Minnesota schools where you had 10% black students, 16% black students, or the Madison school, which was 19%, I think, black students. It's like, well, that's a closer disparity than the educational proficiency disparity, where you had 80% of the students being successful in Minnesota in math and reading, and 80% of the students in the Madison School being unsuccessful in those categories. That seems to be what the district court was doing. Maybe you can point, I know I've gone over time, but I'm curious about your argument. What is the language in the district court's decision that you found to be ethnocentric?
The language I found was the percentages in the school, the racial makeup, which in reading the pleadings, I did not observe where opposing counsel included those percentages. Now, we did not bring that up on appeal, but it's in her order. And
I thought the parties had provided the percentages of diversity, and that was the argument that you were making.
Yes, well, at the request of the court wanted school information, and that's what we provided. And we did provide that information. But I think the court weighed too heavily on that information. And the fact that Wayzata School District is the number one district in the state, I don't think the court should have weighed that heavily, because I think that we run the risk of many parents moving to Wayzata School District because that's the number one school district. And that would be used as a method of saying, this is one of the reasons why my child should be living with me the majority of the time, because I live in the number one school district. And I don't think that's proper.
Okay, thank you. I've let you go quite a bit over, but I've appreciated your argument and very helpful. You will have you still have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Dan McGuire appearing on behalf of the respondent, DeAndre Adams, counsel. As this court knows, district courts have broad discretion in making parenting time decisions and will not be reversed by this court absent an abuse of those discretions, which includes misapplying the law or issuing findings that are simply not supported by the record.
But there's no discretion in what law to apply.
Correct.
So why did the district court apply the right law here in deciding the burdens and standards to apply?
Your Honor, this is a very unique case in that, as Your Honor was alluding to, and quite frankly, as the district court noted, there was no relief really for either party because they were both living in different states. And so the central issue in this case was where the child should attend school. And Your Honor is also correct that that the court, or the appellant, did argue for an evidentiary hearing at the district court level, or argued against an evidentiary hearing at the district court level, and now is switching the position on appeal. So it would be our position as far as that issue goes that issue has been waived for appeal. I did hear appellant argue regarding certain findings that the court was required to make, and specifically findings under Minnesota Statutes 518.17. But I will note that at least according to the Hansen case that I cited in my brief, the court is not required to make specific and detailed findings when it's talking about a parenting time modification. Even so, the court did make specific and detailed findings in this case under 518.175 subdivision 3. The court was not required to do so, however. All the court was required to do in this case was consider and analyze the factors under the move out of state statute, which the court did in this case, by contemplating those issues. So there was no requirement for the court to also make findings under 518.17.
What were when the district court considered the nature of the schools that were at option presented by the parties? Was that a sua sponte inquiry, or did the parties offer
No,
voluntarily offer evidence as to which school would be better and why?
Yes, Your Honor. In the party's pleadings, and specifically in respondents' pleading, we submitted three school choices with print-offs, which discussed the numbers regarding the diversity in those school districts, as well as the academic performance in those school districts. In response to respondents' motion, appellant then submitted her proposed schools with her numbers. And so the numbers were provided by the parties for the district court to consider. And I believe that the district court did a good job in considering the competing schools, in that the district court did not put too much weight on the academic performance of the chosen school. In fact, in the district court's December 26, 2023 order, the district court specifically notes that the reason the court decided to go with the chosen school was essentially the district court's balancing of the academic performance as well as the diversity that that school comes with. Had appellant been successful at the district court, we would be in the exact same position. I mean, the district court had its hands tied, and the district court issued an order that was the best that it could do in the situation and circumstances that it was provided. I do think that that this case is actually analogous to an unpresidential case, but I do think that it should be persuasive for this court. When this court decided Himley, which was cited in a respondent's brief, in Himley, that was a case in which the party's baseline parenting time schedule was a schedule in which one party had parenting time during the summer while the other party had parenting time during the school year. And the parent who had less parenting time then filed a motion for the child to attend school in his district, and the district court, in granting that motion, completely reversed that parenting time schedule. And this court, in reasoning that the parenting time modification was a necessary collateral consequence of the district court's school choice decision, did not construe the district court's order as a restriction of parenting time. Instead, this court reasoned that essentially because it would be unreasonable for the child to travel 80 miles round trip to school every day, the parenting time change was necessary to effectuate the school order. This case is analogous to Himley in that the parties in both cases shared joint legal custody and joint physical custody. And similar to this case, the reason for the change in parenting time in Himley was so the children could attend a particular school. And the change in Himley was even much more drastic than the change that occurred in this case. Even so, the general reasoning in Himley should really guide this court in this case, as it would simply be unreasonable, Your Honor, to require the child to travel not 80 miles, but 4 hours every week during the school year, while still alternating weeks with each parent. Therefore, Your Honor, because the parenting time modification was necessary to effectuate the primary issue in this case, which was where this five-year-old child is supposed to attend school, the district court did not err in determining that that the change was not a restriction, and the district court also did not err in applying a best interest standard and considering all the relevant factors given the residences of the parties.
6 years old, though, right?
I believe the pleadings started when the child was five, but yes, Your Honor is correct. In Danielson, which was a case involving the removal of children to another state, the court noted that a reduction in visiting time is not necessarily a restriction. And in fact, Other cases, such as the Anderson v. Archer case, have kind of set forth this two-part test in determining whether a restriction in parenting time has occurred. And it requires, as this court knows, looking at both the reasons for the change and the amount of the reduction. Everyone knows what the reason for the change was. It was so this child could attend school. Regarding the amount of the reduction prong, I will just note that in this case, I believe that appellant's parenting time, at least pursuant to my calculation, was restricted by between 8 and 16%. But in cases such as Sulesky and Danielson, those courts have determined that parenting time reductions between 7% and 20% did not amount to a restriction. So I believe...
Of course, your argument in appeal also differs from the argument in the district court. I mean, your client was arguing that you court has to have an evidentiary hearing to make these decisions. And now you're making the opposite argument that no evidentiary hearing was necessary.
That is a very valid point, Your Honor. I will just note that I believe what I'm arguing for purposes of this appeal is that appellant, who is now requesting an evidentiary hearing, did not properly preserve that issue. And so that is why I am currently arguing that no evidentiary hearing was required. In fact, this court should not even consider that argument because it was not properly preserved.
Now, we could consider it in the interest of justice, which we do from time to time for arguments that weren't preserved. Why wouldn't we do that here, given the argument that was presented by your client in the district court?
Your Honor, I think it wouldn't make sense in this case to order an evidentiary hearing in this case in the interest of justice because both parties have agreed that there is no endangerment in this case. And because both parties essentially asked for the same relief, just flipped. And so I don't really know what relief or what would necessarily come out of a evidentiary hearing. The child had two primary residences in this case, and as the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated in MJH 2, in determining the primary residence argument, a totality of the circumstances approach is supposed to be taken. I did address that in our brief, the circumstances being that let me back up. This court actually in MJH 1 specifically noted that the whether modification would change a child's primary residence. Indicated that an identification of the child's primary residence is not governed solely by the apportionment of parenting time. I will note that case was overturned, but it was overturned on other grounds. That should guide this court in this case. While the respondent was, in fact, awarded more overall parenting time with the child continues to have two primary residences. In analyzing the totality of the circumstances, the daily care and control is still structured between the parties, in that one party would have the majority of the daily care and control during the school year, while the other party would have the majority of the daily care and control during the summer months. And some other factors that the court did consider in its order are that the child also has family in both states, and that the attachments that the child has with those family members in each state would not be disrupted as well. With that, Your Honor, I don't have anything else. I think that the primary issue that the district court had to consider was the school choice issue, and the hands were really tied. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your Honors. Counselor Appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Calandra Revering, on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Antoinette York. I think the court is correct in citing in the interest of justice, because we have to remember that this child's best interest is at stake. And I know that this court centers on the best interest of the child, along with procedural due process. And that's what we are asking for, due process. Counsel cited in the matter of the custody of MJH. MJH states that when a parenting time modification substantially alters a child's primary residence and parental role, it must be treated as a custody modification and meet the higher legal standard of Minnesota Statute 518.18. MJH also
requiring an endangerment showing.
Yes.
Which the parties acknowledged doesn't exist here in either home.
Yes. But there is other case law that talks about altering the parent-child relationship and custody, which is what we have. We have a de facto change of custody, which requires an evidentiary hearing. This court did not consider the totality of the circumstances when she issued these findings. And what we are asking the court today is, in the interest of justice, we did essentially ask for the same relief. Your Honor, this is a very unique case. We don't deny that. And I know this court has a very, very tough decision to make. But what we're asking for is that Ms. York be granted the procedural due process that we preserved in writing and both that opposing counsel requested, to give these parties an opportunity to be heard, cross-examined, and that a proper findings can be issued by the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel, Ms. Reverend, Ms. McGuire.
Yes.
Nicely done. We appreciate it.
This was my first appeal.
Oh, really? Well, this is great. We
and
should stop
for. We're both from Milwaukee.
Yeah, we are.
You're both from Milwaukee. Okay,
yeah,
very nice.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to Minnesota. Let me just say this. So we'll issue the opinion within the statutory period, and no doubt one of you and one of your clients will be more happy than the other one. But however we decide it, I'm sure you've talked to your clients about this, that whoever ends up with the school time is going to have more overnights but less discretionary time with the child. And whoever ends up with the summer, when you don't have school in the interference, you've got all day to spend with the child and do things. I mean, it may be that one parent ends up being the fun parent, one ends up being the hard, crack the whip, get the schoolwork done. I don't know. But it's a difficult case, and we're going to decide it on the law. But we appreciate your argument. Nicely done, both of you. You're welcome to come back anytime. Hope you do.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.